So I like to talk about attribute-based, what we call attribute-based encryption, and this is done with two UCLA students here, Vipul Goyal and Amkan Pandey, along with Mitzahai. Now, before I talk about attribute-based encryption, I think sort of reviewing identity-based encryption, which I think most people here are familiar with, is pretty useful. So in an IBE scheme, if Alice wants to send an email to Bob, all she needs to know is Bob's identity. Like, let's say his email address, the string bob@stanford.edu. And as we all know, Alice doesn't actually need to access some type of PKI. Now, if Bob actually wants to be able to decrypt these messages that are given to Alice, what he needs to do is to go to some authority here and convince this authority that he actually does indeed own this identity, bob@stanford.edu. And then the authority will issue him the private key, and he can decrypt many, many messages from this. Okay, and typically when we talk about identity-based encryption, usually the counter-argument comes up, is regular public key infrastructure maybe good enough? That is, how important is it that Alice not access one of these PKIs? Now, I really won't go down into this debate today, but what I will try to point out is that I think this identity-based framework is really cool, and we should perhaps like go beyond, view it beyond just what exactly traditional IBE is, and look at it in this more general way. In general, we can think of Alice as encrypting some type of structured data, sort of actually the thing that Dan talked about at length for, just kidding, was some form of structured data. And what Bob does is then he goes to get some type of capability, maybe it's a search capability, maybe it's a more general capability even, and he gets this private capability, and then he can apply it over and over again on different types of ciphertext. Now, what I'm going to talk about today is something we call attribute-based encryption, in which the structure that we encrypt data with is that when Alice encrypts a data, she'll sort of label it with a set of descriptive attributes, in a sense. And now, when users attempt to decrypt the message, what they'll do is they'll get private keys that reflect some type of decryption policy. Like, you will be able to decrypt the message if both this attribute and that attribute is actually present. And again, we have still, hopefully you can see that there's still the same IBE framework where we have this master key authority sort of in the sky that can issue these private key tokens or capabilities. So to motivate attribute-based encryption a little further, let's consider, let's say, an encrypted file system on a university network, for example. Now, unlike like regular file or typical encrypted file systems, we'll be storing encrypted files on untrusted storage servers, such that if the storage server is corrupted, we still want to have some type of security. But unlike regular systems, we won't be encrypting files to a particular user. Like, I won't target it to Jens here. Instead, what I'll do is when I create the file, let's say I'll label it with these attributes, let's say like the file's creator, the department, maybe the subject it had to do with grad school admissions, and also perhaps the date which it was created. And a different file that's created will be labeled with a corresponding different set of attributes. Okay, now in this file system, what Bob will do, if Bob's a user in the system, is that he'll go to the authority and ask him for a private key, and the authority will sort of prescribe to him a private key depending upon, let's say, who he is and what he does, in a sense. For example, if his username is Bob Smith, and he's in the computer science department on the admissions committee, the authority might say, okay, Bob, you can decrypt anything that has both the attributes of CS and emissions, or anything that was had the attribute of your name that was it was actually created by you. So then if Bob gets this key, he can, of course, decrypt this first file because it has CS and emissions, although the second file, he really doesn't satisfy this sort of tree policy that I outlined here. Okay, so for this talk, what I'm going to try to do is to sort of warm up a more general attribute-based encryption system by going over what I'll call a threshold ABE system, or sort of a more simple attribute-based encryption system. And then we'll move on to what I guess is the more advanced attribute-based encryption. And sort of this is the recent work with the students here. And then finally, sort of depending on how much time is left when I get through that, I'll perhaps sort of overview some other kind of related systems and try to put this talk in a larger perspective, in a sense.
So is this a special case of what Dan was talking about, where the attribute is, where the property, the predicate is attribute satisfying?
No, it's not a special case, really. It's related. Actually, I do have a slide in that other systems thing, which kind of puts the talk Dan gave and our talk sort of, or the two systems side by side.
But if I said instead of checking equality, I check that, you know, it equals to your name or equals to somebody else's name.
The system Dan talked about just had conjunctions, right? It was more.
No, I meant the definition, not the construction. I meant the definition, not the
construction. The definition's a little weaker. It'll turn out that you can be more expressive, but you don't hide the attributes. So you can write more expressive decryption policies, but the attributes are in the clear. There will sort of be a slide to make this a little more explicit later on. Okay, so let me start with talking about threshold ABE and its use for biometric identities in IBE. So probably most people here are familiar with, or at least intuitively, with what a biometric is. It's any type of sort of physical property myself, which is somewhat unique to myself at least, such as an iris scan, voice print, and fingerprint. And each time I measure it, there should at least be some type of consistency, although it might be blurred between each measurement. So when I think of a biometric identity, or at least for this talk, when I scan a biometric, I'll just, let's say, relate it to a set of features, where the features that are highlighted in red are sort of the features that are present for this particular scan, and the ones that are in white are ones that are, let's say, not present. Now, sort of the neat things about biometrics are, first of all, that they stay with the human. That is, when I wake up in bed and, you know, drive over to IPAM, I don't need to think, let's say, oh, I need to bring my fingers with me. It's not something that I think about. They should be unique. Also, you don't need to register for them like an email address. You're just kind of born with them, right? And certification is natural. If Rafi's a certificate authority, and I want to convince him I really do have this finger, I just shove it in his face, and he'll be darn certain of it, hopefully. So, however, biometrics are also sort of a pain to work with, and there's been a lot of cryptography papers sort of dealing with this. The problem is that each time I scan my biometric, it'd be sort of similar to the last time, but it might deviate in a few places, let's say to differences in the environment, in sensors, or maybe even a small evolution in the trait over time. What this means, though, is if we want to use these in identity-based encryption, we just can't plug in Bonnet Franklin or any type of prior IB system. The main reason, of course, is that prior IB systems see identities as fixed strings. And now if these strings vary each time that you measure them, when I encrypt it, my private key string is going to be different than the string I encrypt the message under. Okay. So what we really, when Amit and I first looked at this problem, what we wanted to do was to have some type of IBE-like system, but with error tolerance in the identity. That is, if I encrypt the message under this string, and my private key is for this sort of attribute set, the fact that they, let's say, line up in at least five places, just for this slide, I'll just say five is the biometric threshold, then the user should be able to decrypt the message. However, if someone else comes to the authority and he gets a private key for something that's wildly different from my biometric, let's say it only lines up in three places, he shouldn't be able to decrypt the message. Okay. So this would be our main goal, at least for this talk, is to how to realize such as, or for the beginning of the talk, I should say. Okay, the main technique. Yeah?
So your goal is to use attribute-based encryption in order to do biometric?
Okay, so I think I misstated that last statement. So in general, attribute-based encryption is sort of this general property that I outlined where you encrypt data with a bunch of attributes, and then you can make an expressive policy based on these attributes about whether you're able to decrypt. I'm sort of doing a warm-up where I'm saying, okay, let's look at a threshold policy, which is sort of a special case, and it's actually the first case that Amit and I looked at in, a year or two ago now. And then what I'm gonna do from there is I'm gonna sort of talk about the more general case just in terms of it, it'll sort of expand upon the special case in some sense. Okay, yeah, I'm trying to talk a little faster than I normally would like, just to make sure we keep on schedule, of course. Okay, so the way we're gonna, as maybe this might not be so surprising, but one of the main tools we're going to use in order to sort of realize our scheme is that we're gonna apply a secret sharing scheme, in particular the Shamir secret sharing scheme, which is if we wanna split a secret, let's say M, into shares such that you need exactly K or greater than of them to decrypt. And the way we do this is that, of course, we choose a random K minus 1 degree polynomial and set Q such that Q of 0 is equal to the secret M. And then if we get at least K points, we're able to, of course, interpolate this polynomial and reconstruct our secret M. I think most likely almost everyone here is, of course, familiar with this. Okay, so now what I'll do is I'll sort of take a first sort of naive hack at solving the problem above using secret sharing, and then we'll kind of get to our main scheme and sort of what the real techniques are, in a sense. Okay, so for the first method, we can imagine for each of these attributes in, let's say, a biometric here, where there's a total of n features in the universe, what I'll do is I'll create a unique sort of public-private key pair for each set. And then when I encrypt, I'll encrypt shares of the message. That is, I'll just split the secret over all these messages. And what I'll do is that for each feature that's active in the public key or in the iris that I scan when I'm encrypting the message, I'll encrypt a share of that message under that public key. For example, for the under since this third feature is active here, what I'll do is I'll encrypt Q of 3, where Q is the sort of the split, under the third key. I won't encrypt anything under the fourth under the fourth key because it's not active here. And I'll encrypt something under the fifth key and so on and so forth. And now if I go to Rafi again and I show him my blue eye, I guess, what I'll do is that he'll measure a sort of feature set of me, which will be different than, perhaps a little bit different than when I encrypted. And he'll give me the private keys corresponding to each feature that I actually have. And now to decrypt, I can just sort of line these things up in 5 different places, or in general, k different places. And when I do this, I can recover all these shares and interpolate and get the message. Now, I don't know if it's clear, but this fails fairly miserably to a very, very, very simple collusion attack. Well, let's pretend that Amit and I get together. And what we do is we sort of combine our private keys, and what we can do is that we can sort of aggregate them and get a sort of a hybrid biometric between us. And using this biometric key, I should say, and using this set of keys, we can decrypt messages that neither one of us alone was able to decrypt. And this is, of course, the crux of the whole problem, is to prevent these types of collusion attacks. And you can imagine if I threw a couple more users into this colluding set, I'll just have all the keys in the whole system and I can decrypt anything. Okay, so for our approach to this problem, there's gonna really be 2 goals. The first is we're gonna wanna have some type of threshold property. That is, if I hit this threshold, I should be able to decrypt, and if I'm below it, I shouldn't be able to decrypt. And also, the challenge of all these problems, actually including the stuff that Dan talked about, is to be able to do some type of collusion resistance. That is, if 2 of us get together, we shouldn't be able to sort of combine our keys or combine a decryption attempt to get something that neither one of us was actually able to get. And to do this, we'll use secret sharing in a private key, which I'll explain a little bit more. And I guess it shouldn't be so surprising that the bilinear map tool will rear its head again. Okay, so let me just, the slides between Dan and I, people might notice a sort of some redundancy between them, but so let me just briefly review bilinear maps again.
Just check my understanding.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's like, well, and authority is completely trusted.
This is a tricky question.
Let's pretend that Amit was the authority, and well, that makes more sense. Okay. But the answer is yes, of course. It's just like identity-based encryption, and we can.
Yeah, but this is the person who's.
Yeah, it's Sorry?
He doesn't have to. Because he's checking, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he has to have to. I mean, you could imagine a weaker verifier. Someone who's checking that you have the right hand and fingerprints, but doesn't have the abilities. At least in the way you describe it.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe I'll talk about it a little bit more at the end. I think, in general, it is the IB setup where there is a key authority in the sky that. You're saying the decryptor's not trusted.
You're giving, in that scheme that you described, giving Rafi the secret keys with the right location.
Oh, okay. So in what I was describing, I was making Rafi the authority.
I thought somebody gave that person has a fingerprint, the key.
So what I was trying to say was that I went up to, Rafi's the key authority, and let's say he is trusted for right now. And I go up to him, and I show him my biometric. He reads it and makes sure it's actually attached to my hand, etc. And then what happens is that he issues me a private key.
I thought that was the place where you went to in the border and showed you the fingerprint.
No.
This isn't for authenticity. This is for decryption. It's a private. Think of it as like an IBE key. So it's not just. Yeah, it's not checking. It's sort of to give a private key.
I'm an encryptor, right? So I encrypt every place. Now there's a public key. Every time you want to decrypt, you go to Rafi, and Rafi gives you the specific places of
the key. No. So I go to Rafi once, and I get a private key corresponding to my, let's say, my pinky finger here. And then I'm not going to go into the motivation biometrics. Now, if I happen to be in this room, and let's say we wanted to encrypt a video image of this talk under my key, I'll scan my pinky finger there, and we'll encrypt it. And maybe I go somewhere else, and we encrypt it under my biometric again. And then later on when I go home, I can take my private key, and I can use it to decrypt many, many different types of messages. In identity-based encryption, you don't need to go to the authority for
every
time.
So you are both the encryptor and the decryptor?
No.
The person with the
anyone can be the encryptor. Anyone that knows my biometric can be the encryptor.
So
your public key is your public biometric?
Yeah, my identity is my biometric. There's nothing secret. Unlike, let's say, fuzzy extractors or the stuff that, Adam and Yevgeny work on, let's say, everyone can know my biometric in this particular system. It's like an email address. There is nothing secret about my email address. And likewise, in this type of a system.
Unfortunately,
there's nothing secret about my email address. And in this type of a system, we're going to use the biometric as an identity. So if I show you my biometric, you'll use it as my identity, and you can encrypt to me. And then later on, I can, if I have the corresponding private key that was issued from an authority, I can apply it to decrypt
the
message.
So you publish your biometric once, and that's the public key, and also Rafi gives you secret keys according to that once.
Yeah. If you sort of remove the fuzziness property of biometrics, it's exactly equal to IB, for example. And that's one way to think about it. Okay, so I'll move on with this. Okay, so a quick review of bilinear maps are that we have a bilinear group G and a target group G1, and that we say there's an admissible bilinear map from two groups of the bilinear group G into G1 if, when we pair them, if we pair G to the A with G to the B, we get E of G, G to the AB. It should also be non-degenerate. That is, if G generates G, E of G, G will be a generator of G1. And finally, it must, of course, be efficiently computable. The main thing to think of here is that we really just do sort of a multiplication in the exponent for all intents and purposes of this talk. Okay, so let me describe sort of the threshold attribute-based encryption system. And in this system, an authority, going with analogy Rafi here, will run the setup phase, and he'll choose a generator G along with secret exponents Y and then T1 through Tn, where there's a total of n features in this whole universe. And he'll publish E of G, G to the Y, along with G to the T1, G to the T2, all the way to G of Tn. Okay, now I'll try to sort of pictorially outline how the private keys and decryption work. Okay, so again, when I go to the authority and I show him my iris, he'll have to generate a private key for me. In this case, he'll pick a random polynomial of degree 4, because we're matching on 5 up to 5 points, in general it's k points, right? Such that q of 0 will be equal to y. So he picks a random polynomial when I come in to get my private key. And then for each feature that's present, what he'll do is he'll give me, let's say for the fifth feature, he'll give me g raised to the q of 5 divided by t of 5, where t of 5 is from the parameters, and q of 5 was for this polynomial that was generated uniquely for me. And then he won't give me the sixth one, but will give me the seventh one, and so on and so forth. Now, when someone encrypts a message to me, they'll scan my iris again, and perhaps they'll get a sort of a different readout of the iris, or a slightly different readout. Well, the way they will encrypt the message is that the encryptor first chooses a random exponent r and blinds the message with e of gg to the ry. And this sort of blinding factor can be easily computed from this part up here. Okay. Now, for each feature that's present here, what we'll do is we'll take g to the t of 5, let's say for the fifth feature, and then raise it to the r, and so on and so forth for every single thing that's present here. Okay, so now if I'm at home and I see the ciphertext and I have my private key, the way I decrypt is I search for five places where sort of the ciphertext and the private key identities are five features where these two attributes line up at. And what I'll do is I'll do a pairing for these. And what this pairing really does is it just cancels out this these sort of T5 or T sub I factors just cancel out when you multiply them together. And what you get is you get E of GG to the RQ of 5, or in general RQ of X, in at least five places. And now what you can do is you can simply do polynomial interpolation, this time albeit in the exponent, in order to get E of GG to the RQ of 0. However, recall that we set Q of 0 equal to the secret Y, and what really pops out is this blinding factor here. So notice really what I did was I embedded the secret sharing scheme into the private keys themselves and sort of created a new secret sharing scheme over each private key that I issue. Okay, to sort of argue intuitively why this is secure, well, first we notice that the threshold property does hold. That is, if I pair this at least k places, I can interpolate a degree, or k minus 1 degree polynomial. Secondly, we want to think about why is it actually hard to collude. Let's say Amit and I want to get together again and collude. However, when I came in, I got a polynomial q of x, and when Amit came in, he got a different polynomial q prime of x. And it turned, of course, we need to actually prove this for the paper, but intuitively it turns out that we can't really combine our shares of decryption because therefore their shares are really for completely different polynomials, and if we sort of try to mix and match things, we're matching shares from my random polynomial with Amit's random polynomial, and it just doesn't work out. And in the paper, we actually reduced this to what is these days a fairly mild assumption, I guess, which is given g to the a, g to the b, g to the c, it's hard to distinguish e of gg to the ab over c from a random group element. Okay? Okay, well, so now at this point, check here. I sort of talked about threshold attribute-based encryption, but for this original motivating example of this encrypted file system, you'll probably think that really having a policy which can just express things in terms of thresholds really isn't that expressive. I mean, we can sort of graft some sort of cheat and graft some solutions onto this threshold system, but I think eventually doing this type of grafting is going to hit a wall in a sense. And if we think about a previous solution, what we really did was we embedded a Shamir secret sharing scheme into the private keys of themselves. And I think the main observation for our further work with these UCLA students was, can we embed sort of more general policies based off of, let's say, more general linear secret sharing schemes into the private keys and come up with, let's say, more expressive policies? Let's say something like this we might hope for. And in general, we can. I know I'm going to attribute this to Benelow, but I know there's a ton of work on linear secret sharing schemes, of course. And what we're going to try to do is to embed sort of these monotonic access trees, sharing structures, into these keys. And the way these work for just secret sharing is that whenever we start with a secret at the top, and then whenever there's an OR gate, we replicate the secret across the two child nodes, and whenever there's an AND gate, we sort of randomly split it. And this can go on sort of for infinite, could go on indefinitely as part of the process. So every time it's an OR gate, we replicate, and AND gate, we split. Okay. Now, for key, now the recent work with the UCLA students was that we wanted to have key policy attribute, what we called key policy attribute-based encryption. In this type of a system, I won't outline the details, but the encryption structure is similar to the threshold case. However, the private keys will reflect a more expressive type of access structure. And again, the key point is that we sort of randomize per private key to prevent against these collusion attacks. And instead of AND or OR gates, we actually make these threshold gates, but that's just a sort of minor detail. And really what you can do is you can decrypt if and only if you can sort of plug the attributes from the ciphertext into this type of a key. Or I'm sorry, into a particular user's policy, and then you will be able to decrypt. One other kind of cool thing that popped out of this work is that we actually get some type of delegation. That is, if Bob here has a key for a certain type of policy, and and he's let's say he wants to restrict his key in some type of way, he can do something like saying, "Well, if I'm going to satisfy it in this way, I'll also acquire that it you know, the email or file was encrypted in the year 2005." And what we can really do is just delegate to any type of more restrictive access structure. And the cool thing about this is we kind of seen a lot of papers on, let's say, a hierarchical IBE, for example. And if you play with the attributes in the right way, you'll see that using attribute-based encryption with delegation really gives you a hierarchical IBE. And we can also cover these corner cases, like there's this wildcard IBE where I want to encrypt here and then have a wildcard here for some reason. And then have enough, and then, okay, let's not worry about that. But it subsumes hierarchical IBE is the main thing. Okay, so I wanted, this is sort of getting back to your question at the very beginning. I wanted to put sort of side by side the system that Dan talked about, which I guess was called hidden vector encryption, but I don't know if we ever got to that name. And attribute-based encryption. So in... Well, if we put them side by side, we can really think of this, they really are related in some way. However, in our system, we can encrypt, when someone encrypts, they can pick an arbitrary number of attributes to describe the data, whereas sort of these fields in the system that Dan talked about are fixed at setup. And also, in their type of, or in the system that was described before, there's really, you can only express policies in terms of conjunctions along with don't cares for a certain field. Whereas we have a much more expressive policy. You can make AND or OR gates or all these types of thresholds. Of course, there has to be some type of a trade-off, you would hope. And the main trade-off here is that the attributes for our system, in order to sort of reconstruct these trees or decrypt the ciphertext, these attributes need to be out in the clear. And as Dan was talking about, there are like a lot of cases where actually you might want to hide the attributes. So one type of interesting open problem is, can we move towards getting the best of both worlds? And I think Dan, at least implicitly, kind of gave this as an open problem. Can we make more and more expressive searching types of problems? Okay, I don't have too much more to say, so I'll just finish off. Another type of, this is in the other systems part of my talk, to sort of put this in perspective. Another type of attribute-based encryption we might think is interesting is actually ciphertext, what we call ciphertext policy ABE. In this type of a case, we're going to sort of do things in the opposite way. Instead of the authority prescribing a decryption policy to the user, what he'll do is he'll use the attributes to actually describe the user now. Let's say all his capabilities. He's blonde. He's well dressed. He doesn't look too tall. I mean, it's hard to tell from the slide. But and he's of age 21, let's say. Now, the key issuing authority is sort of dumb in the sense it just looks at the user and prescribes them all these attributes. And what we're going to do is kind of move all the power into the person of expressiveness of the person encrypting the data. And let's say Alice here wants to go onto a dating service, and she wants to encrypt a phone number, but she's kind of particular about who gets to read it. Okay, well, she wants to meet someone who's smart in her age range. Well, I guess he's already disqualified for that. And the person has to be a Rhodes Scholar and between 25 and 35, But perhaps she's willing to make some exceptions if he is a particularly rich person. So, oh, okay. But here, really, the main point is not the dating service, but now we see an application which we want to give the expressive power to the user and make the key issuer sort of dumb, in a sense. And I don't know if you still want to be the key issuer. And for other applications we might want to flip things around. Unfortunately, we don't have a system, this is kind of an open problem and turns out to be a little more difficult to construct. Okay, finally I thought I'd sort of plug someone else's work here a little bit. I think Melissa Chase, who's also visiting IPAM for this term, sort of did things with multiple authorities. Like, let's say the DMV is sort of master of these attributes, let's say attributes to do with your physical traits, and the IRS with your financial traits. And since I'm running low on time, I'll just say sort of the main challenge there is to make sure, how do we make sure that Amit and I, again, don't collude, like Amit doesn't go to the DMV, and I go to the IRS, and we sort of combine our attributes or our private keys from there. And especially if you don't have the DMV and IRS doing some type of online communication with each other. And I think the main idea, at least from what I understood from her paper, is that if there's sort of one globally verifiable ID, sort of unique ID, you can sort of use this to tie private keys together across different authorities. So I guess Melissa will get a chance to correct me or at another point in time or explain things better. Okay, so as sort of some open problems, there's the ciphertext policy with ABE. Can we do more advanced searching systems in which the attributes are hidden? I won't bother to talk about the last one. And I'll just try to see what I think of as really the big open problem is, again, going to this general framework where we have a capability request and then we get a general private capability. And this is sort of my holy grail, in a sense. This is kind of an example of my holy grail of what I've been talking about. Let's say that Alice wants to encrypt a health record with the structure in it again, where she has her weight, her height, her age, and her blood pressure, maybe a partner she's been with or something. And Bob is given the capability from this authority to see that if her body mass index, which is weight divided by height, say times some constant, is greater than 30, and her age is greater than 45, then he should learn her blood pressure for some reason. So this exact example is not the holy grail, but in general, we like to be able to sort of have any type of program here that can output any type of function on structured data. And as I think Dan kind of alluded to, we're pretty far away from actually doing this right now, but I think it's good to keep this goal in mind. Okay.
So what is the relationship between this, the problems you mentioned towards the end of doing general circuits and let's say general secret sharing over general access structures?
Over circuits instead of trees. Well, that problem still has the attributes in the clear. So for this last problem that I've talked about.
Actually one before.
This?
Let's say this one, yeah.
That one down there?
Yeah.
Okay, so I built them from linear secret sharing schemes in which the access structures were
right.
made from trees.
Yeah, yeah, right. But I'm yeah. saying, what is the, you're asking what happens with circuits.
Oh, well,
now, then we have the general problem of constructing secret sharings.
Yeah. So this is kind of why it's hard. It's because I based them off of secret sharing schemes, and we don't know how to do that with circuits. If we had more advanced algebra, who knows? I mean, if there were whatever n-linear maps, whatever, maybe there's some other tricks to be played. We could sort of leverage algebra. Yeah. But I think you're exactly right. The restrictions mirror each other, in a sense. Okay. I guess Adam.
In the construction key, is it specific to the formula, monotone formulas, or can you do anything you can do with a linear secret sharing?
So we have some sort of theoretical result that says you can do it with any type of linear secret sharing scheme. Sort of the what I like to do is I like to show this sort of tree policy because that's the most natural one to think about, let's say.
But that's more powerful. I mean, the result saying there are things you can do with linear secret sharing schemes that take, you know, exponential size monotone formula and things.
There's some theoretical results we have, like where we can take any, what's it called?
Linear secret sharing.
No, yeah, not linear, but yeah, there's some more theoretical results, but I chose to sort of skip over.
But they're all linear to NC.
I think this is kind of related to Moni's question. You might, with more advanced algebra, you might be able to do something. It's not clear that the limits of, sort of the information theoretic limits of some secret sharing schemes imply limitations for these types of schemes. On the other hand, we don't know how to sort of move further. Okay.